saving money on your next painting project with Menards. Get a paint that combines gorgeous color and durability. Dutch Boys Platinum Plus is a paint and primer with a protective finish that guards against scuffs, spills, and stains. Get $15 off instantly on a single qualifying purchase of $100 or more on Dutch Boy and Purdy products. Now through March 8th. Plus, check out our weekly flyer on Menards.com for more great deals happening now. Save big money
at Menards. Hey, this is DeRay, and welcome to Pod Save the People. In this episode, it's me, Miles, and Sharonda talking about the news from the past week, and Lord knows these have just been wild weeks. And this is a special episode for two reasons. One is that it's Juneteenth, so shout out to Juneteenth. And shout out to everybody who has off on Juneteenth, who might have a long weekend. You deserve it. And also because this is the last week of the mayoral primary in New York City, the largest city in the country. There are a lot of incredible candidates. We have one on today, Brad Lander, who's currently the comptroller of New York City. And I'm excited for you to hear our conversation. Here we go. Why are Democrats losing young voters? Because the game has changed and the old playbook doesn't cut it anymore. In the latest episode of Assembly Required, Stacey Abrams talks with Aaron Parnas, a sharp political commentator, and Khalil Green, a Gen Z historian who knows social media inside and out. They break down how the right has dominated platforms like TikTok and YouTube by putting the right messengers front and center, and why Democrats need to stop chasing the same strategies and start listening to the voices that actually get it. Tune into this episode of Assembly Required now, wherever you get your podcasts or on YouTube. This episode is our Juneteenth episode. Shout out to Juneteenth and freedom, especially in these trying times. But this is DeRay at DRAY on Twitter.
I'm Sharonda Bossier. You can find me on LinkedIn or at BossierS on Spill. And I will have, I think, an Instagram handle for y'all come next episode. I think Miles has finally sold me on getting back. So looking forward to telling y'all what that is next week. I'm crowdsourcing. Well, leave ideas in the comments.
Miles, through the power of woke Katy Perry, she transformed me. So yeah,
not well, Katy Perry. Well, let's start with the hardest news is that as everybody who's listening should have heard by now, there were two legislators in Minnesota who were killed by a mid-50s white man, political assassin at this point, who showed up at their houses in a latex mask dressed like the police. He, as of our recording on Sunday, June 15th, is still at large and has not been found. He did have a manifesto with many other legislators' names in his car when they did encounter him. If you didn't know how they encountered him, is that once the police got to the first house and realized that he killed somebody, they went to a legislator's house who also lived close. Just the officer had like the intuition to do it. At that house, he ran into the guy. They exchanged gunshots. That's how we got the car. So he's still at large, which is wild. And I don't know if you saw Trump's tweet, but Trump's tweet about walls is like, I haven't talked to him. He's a pretty awful guy. I might call him. You're like, man, the two people in the state just got killed. This is what you want? So I wanted to bring it here because, you know, we are seeing an escalation of the violence that the Trump regime is causing. And I wanted to know what you all thought about what's going on in Minnesota.
I think exactly that. We talked similarly about Trump's remarks when it was announced that Biden had cancer. And I just think that Trump knows that this violence is happening in his name. He won't renounce it. And he doesn't even have the decency to do the usual, you know, niceties, pleasantries to honor that people have lost their lives, right? And I think we are seeing a breaking of cultural and political norms, a continued breaking of those norms. And I think it's really devastating to those people and to their families that they committed their lives to public service and can't even be recognized for that, because this is going to be another thing that people are going to leverage to advance their own ideological or political priorities.
Is this manifesto released?
The manifesto is not released.
Okay. Because everything that I've read so far sounds like that the person who assassinated these two representatives would identify as somebody who's on the left.
No, no, no. So what they have said is that he was appointed to a commission by the current governor, who is a Democrat, but it was a nonpartisan commission. You know, the governors appoint 8,000 people to commissions, but he's a registered Republican. He has roommates who have confirmed that he was a Trump supporter, was a Republican. What he did have is these like homemade No King signs in the front seat of his car, but they looked like some hero and went to the copy machine and like printed them. They weren't like protest signs. Like they sort of looked like some signs in the front that the police put up, but no, every indication is that he was a hardcore Trump supporter, anti-abortion, Christian fundamentalist.
Yeah, this is interesting. And I feel like when everything happened with Luigi, I had a similar thought on this podcast about how we're going to continue to see these kind of really violent political moments. And then how also these violent political moments are going to be representative of these kind of almost mutated politics. I'm really curious about this manifesto. I'm curious about the right wingers who are blowing up Teslas. I'm curious about the kind of eruption that seems to be happening on the right wing, but then also a lot of people who are on the left who are also finding it pragmatic to use like lethal force and violence in order to establish their political wants too. So I don't know. This feels in the pool of that. Like it's just, I'm really curious to see everything that comes up, because isn't this the same person who, like, this was after an election around healthcare?
I think she was no longer in the state legislature, right? But she had been the face of the Democrats' victory in enshrining like abortion rights and in some of the big wins that were counter to the values that this man and the Republicans hold on some of the kind of key issues in the state. And so I certainly think that her targeting was symbolic for that reason.
The other thing is that he killed one representative and one senator. The Democrats in Minnesota have a one-person majority in both of those houses. So by killing one in each house, the Democrats no longer have a majority in the Minnesota legislature. So that mattered in that way. And this is just so sad, and it's scary to... You know, what's also wild is that the Republicans in Congress after this had a session with Johnson, the Speaker of the House, saying that they are nervous now and they want security. What are y'all thoughts on the impending war between Israel and Iran that it seems like the United States has been dragged into or through Trump has willingly participated in?
Yeah, I mean, I think other people who have far larger platforms than I have already said that when the United States didn't hold Israel to any of what we should hold our allies to with respect to their actions in Gaza, Israel was going to take that as a blank check to do whatever else they wanted to do. And we see that happening in Lebanon. We see that happening now in Iran. And my sense is that Israel has just decided that the U.S. is going to provide both a blank check and blanket justification for any actions they take. I live, I think, as we have talked about previously, too, in a very large Jewish community in Los Angeles. And so the conversations that my neighbors had, you know, like after October 7th were conversations about feeling afraid to be, you know, visibly Jewish, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. And now those conversations have shifted and the tone of the post in our neighborhood WhatsApp group are far more war hawkish. At least those are the voices that are bubbling up to the top. And so it's also just been interesting over the course of the past, you know, 8-9 months to watch that evolution where people have gone from, you know, I'm really afraid to be out in public to essentially run up, get done up energy. And that has been certainly what's been happening in the broader discourse that I have been privy to among my neighbors and other folks in my community.
Yeah, I think that once again, I'm just so frustrated with these like global political topics, because it's like every single regime blames the other regime on how come we're in this place. And I'm like, no, the Democrats allowed Israel to do whatever they want to do. Even now, we're still seeing, I think a lot of times we see how people's reaction to, let's say, the protests or the ICE raid protests, and how the communication around that via media legacy feels off. We're seeing how much that same craft was used for Israel. We're seeing how that was used in order to manufacture consent. And it just honestly fills me with such a kind of like, I don't know, radical cynicism around either party, because I'm like, no, everybody pressed go on this. This is because of everybody's participation in wanting to help with the genocide and the colonization of Palestine.
Also, MTV legend, and I remember watching Teen Summit and being like, oh my God, one day I'm going to be cool enough to be on Teen Summit. And Ananda Lewis was one of the first sort of cool newscasters. I remember my cousin was like in the audience, Justin. My cousin was in the audience at Teen Summit once, and it like blew my mind. I'm like, oh my God, this is so crazy. Ananda just passed due to cancer. So rest in peace, Ananda, and wanted to bring her up on the pod.
Yes, rest in peace to Ananda. I think what is most sad and what my friends and I have been talking about is her decisions around the treatments that she was open to and the ones that she refused. I think that, you know, I've never faced a cancer diagnosis, so I don't know if I would opt for a double mastectomy, right? I don't know if I would opt for chemo. I don't know if I would opt for radiation. I really don't know, right? But I think what a lot of us are focused on and what I think her passing opens up opportunities for conversation around is the ways in which our growing distrust of the like medical system and like medical institutions mean that people are opting out of care that has a proven track record of at the very least prolonging people's lives, right? And so like, I think, what does it mean when there's growing public distrust of these institutions, when there's growing public distrust of treatments, when there's growing public distrust of medicine, and how that might impact, you know, people's lives and like life expectancy. And I'm especially thinking about the rising cancer rates we are seeing, particularly in Black communities, right? And I'm terrified of what it means if more of us opt out of treatment. So the conversations I've been having in my group chats and in my family have been really around her choices on the treatment front.
Yeah, I don't think anybody who is Black in this era specifically, yeah, like this era of digital media, and I was born in like 91, so I would think that anybody from like 81 to like 95 would have been super engaged with Ananda Lewis, and it would be hard to say that her influence didn't motivate so many of us to want to pursue social media, because I think so much of what we're doing now is an amalgamation of what VJ host would do, keeping culturally and politically current, but then also being really cool and trying to figure out that balance. And I think Ananda in her way was such a good blueprint for that. And then Sharonda, what you were saying too, what this has made me think of, because I've been on my own health journey, and also I just am fascinated with algorithms and the realities that we create both in our minds in our external reality based off of the feedback loop that is an algorithm. It makes, because I've been on my health journey, I've created a health algorithm, right? And you see what's being said to you and the calorie deficit and the bodies that are being given to you and stuff like that. And how that once those kind of feedback loops are crystallized, it's really hard to punctuate them. And it's really hard to build friction. It's necessary to build friction with the algorithms that you're given, so you can get more advice and so you can have a bigger idea of maybe what the world and what your choices are. So it makes me sad to think that she didn't have it. But to your point, this is a distrust that it was structurally invented. this is a distrust. Her death was, you know, she died at 52, but this death was hundreds of years in the making, because this distrust from Black people for the medical industry and from people in the medical industry, they have the medical industry has worked really hard to make it so we distrust them. And now we're beginning to see the results of that.
I want to read a quote that Ananda put on Instagram. She said, quote, "For a really long time, I've refused mammograms, and that was a mistake." She did this in October of 2020. "If I had done the mammograms from the time they were recommended when I turned 40, they would have caught the tumor in my breast years before I caught it through my own self-exam." And she, before her passing, she said she wants people to learn from her mistakes and learn from her victories so that other women don't have to go through this in that same way. She's just so young. I mean, goodness. Also, F cancer royally, and hopefully we will find a cure for cancer in this lifetime.
Hey, you're listening to Pod Save the People. Stay tuned, there's more to come.
Save big money on your next painting project with Menards. Get a paint that combines gorgeous color and durability. Dutch Boys Platinum Plus is a paint and primer with a protective finish that guards against scuffs, spills, and stains. Get $15 off instantly on a single qualifying purchase of $100 or more on Dutch Boy and Purdy products. Now through March 8th. Plus, check out our weekly flyer on Menards.com for more great deals happening now. Save big money at Menards.
We're going to go to the news. Now, I am going to ask you, both of you, Miles and Sharonda, if there's anything about food stamps that you are learning for the first time as I'm talking about it, I want to know, because part of what I think, you know, it's interesting when people say, like, you know, people support the Trump stuff broadly and da-da-da, my gut is always like they just don't really know what that what is, and that the narrative, we've lost the narrative so much. So what got me to this is you probably heard that in the big, beautiful bill, the crazy thing that the Republicans are pushing, it is a big rollback of food stamps. And the way the rollback happens is through work requirements for food stamps. And when you poll work requirements, people are like, yes, they should have to work if we're giving them money for food. So that idea is really popular. I will start with a quiz for both of you. I mean, you might have read this in the prep, but are there work requirements now? Do you know?
Oh, I don't think there are.
Okay. I don't think there are. And then what do you think the average amount is per person per day for food stamps in a month?
Like $12 or $13.
Miles is at $12.13.
Yeah, about that.
Okay. So the average amount, and this is from the congressional, this is from the Center for Budget and Policy Priorities. The average amount in 2015, as calculated by the government, is $6.16 per day. It is about $187 a month per person. Now, there actually are work requirements already in the law, and they are for a subset of the population. So today, if you are age 18 to 54 and without children, they can get food stamps for only 3 months in a 3-year period if they do not work. If they want it for longer than 3 months in a 3-year period, they have to show compliance with a 20-hour per week work requirement, or they have to have an exemption. Like they have to be disabled or some, they have to be unable to work.
Was there also a requirement that if they couldn't, they had to be actively like enrolled in like a job seeking program or service? Also as one of the ways they could get an exemption. Sorry.
Yeah, they can volunteer. They can do other things that are not like money,
paid work,
but they have to like prove it. And it's 80 hours a month is the requirement. So it breaks down to 20 hours. So there already is a work requirement, but when we poll people and ask people, they think there's not a work requirement. And most people think that it's much more money than it is. And I don't know if you remember, Miles, I don't think you were on the podcast, but we talked about Louisiana rolling back the summer benefits for kids. So in the state of Louisiana, they get, were you here then?
No, but I remember this because I was working with educators in Louisiana who were like, this literally is a lifeline to the children in our communities. Like they do not eat if we do not feed them.
So they get, parents got food stamps per kid for the summer because there wasn't school lunch. And that amount was $120 for the summer. And you're like, well, who's feeding, what's going on? So I just say that to say the money is much lower than people think. So the question is, what are they proposing in the Republican bill? So what they're proposing in the bill is that they are trying to go outside of the window of 54. So they want to increase the work requirement to people from 55 to 64, whereas right now it's 18 to 54. So they are saying that the 55-year-olds to 64-year-olds should also have to work 20 hours a week. Right now, if you have a kid under the age of 8, you are also automatically exempt. They want to include the people who have kids under 8 in the work requirements as well. So those are the two big eligibility things. The third big thing that most people don't know is that the federal government actually covers 100% of the cost for the food benefits. The states only pay for the administrative function of like giving out the food stamps, but the government covers the lion's share of it, which is like the benefit itself. Under this bill, the states will now have to cover 3/4 of the administrative costs, and then they will have to start paying a portion of the food benefits. So they will be charged for the food itself. The Congressional Budget Office has estimated that some states will probably have to get rid of food stamps entirely because they will just not be able to pay for it if they have, because they didn't budget for this, because the federal government has paid for it since we have food stamps. So if you've read about it, that's why they say they think 3 million people get kicked off food stamps. It's because of the way the requirements work. But I bring it here because food stamps have not been talked about a lot. I think that the storytelling around work requirements and the amount, people think that people are like cashing in on food stamps. And you're like, I think we could just give people $6 a day and not require them to do much, because I don't really know what you're doing with $6 a day anyway. And putting this to the states is actually just going to be a really interesting and sneaky back-end way to just get rid of food stamps altogether. And by the time people realize it, it'll already be done. So I brought it here because I'm fascinated by this as a policy issue. I'm super fascinated by it as a storytelling and messaging issue. The Trump administration is working really insidiously. I'm mad at every Democrat who voted for any part of this. And I brought it here because I'm obsessed with food stamps. Obsessed. Boom.
Yeah, I mean, this is one of those ways and one of those places where the Democrats actually led the charge and then kind of like the Republicans like took the ball and ran it further downfield, right? Because a lot of the stuff that we are talking about, limits and work requirements, et cetera, were part of Clinton's effort to, you know, reimagine, or what he said very plainly was in welfare as we know it, right? And the reason that I thought we had like increased the levels was because I just assumed that like sometime between those numbers from 2015 and 2025, we were like, people should at least get $300 or $400 a month to eat. I mean, you can't even buy eggs for every day. You know what I mean? And the thing is that like, you know, I have siblings who, you know, have been on and off public assistance. You know, we were talking earlier, since it's Father's Day, about our parents before we hit record. Like, I remember being in college and like having to take my mother, who struggled with addiction her entire life, to like these appointments to like get whatever thing she needed so that she could, you know, keep access to her public benefits, et cetera, et cetera. And there is a part of me that was like, and yet before the end of every month, I know who in my family is going to hit me up to be like, hey, do you have, can I borrow, right? And so I have never been under the illusion that people who are reliant on public benefits or public assistance are like living high off the hog at all, right? I'm too proximate to those people. But what I didn't know was like the hard figures, right? And I think to your point, DeRay, about the storytelling, I'm trying to think of where and when I bought into this narrative that we had actually increased public benefits or had raised the floor, and like wondering who told me that I believed. And my sense is it had to have been a Democrat, right? Like, for it to have stuck for me, it had to have been a Democrat. And I'm like, y'all mofos was lying to me. You know what I'm saying? So I'm having another one of those things where, to your point, I do need to look under the hood again, and I do need to, I really thought we had, and maybe it's a California thing, right? Tried to do better by our poorest families.
I think Biden did do some stuff when it comes to a lot of stuff when it comes to food stamps. And okay. I remember being on the podcast when I quit my last job in New York and I was surviving off this meager Cricket Media appearance fee and I had to be on food stamps. Oh my goodness. Dark ages. And I remember being really transparent on here because I forgot what the topic was, but it just felt like I should be honest about where I was placed economically in order to talk about this truthfully. And
wait, can I just say real quick? So Biden did, but they both sunsetted. So he put it in the omnibus.
Oh, okay.
It was a benefit of 15% increase, but it was through June 2021. And then the American Rescue Plan Act extended it again through September 2021, but the Biden couldn't get like a permanent change into the law.
I see. Okay.
I think that the whole idea of food stamps is so dinosaurs. I think that was one of the things that radicalized me during my moment of expressing me being in food stamps and me going through that was, like, I remember being in my early 20s or late teens by myself, my own apartment, and, like, getting on food stamps or whatever, and not having any, like, qualms about it. Maybe that was the Atlanta culture or whatever. I was like, girl, I'm about to get these stamps because that's what I need to go do. And as I guess like my political education expanded, I was just thinking about how insulting it is. It makes sense that Biden was not able to get people excited around food stamps because food stamps is an inadequate, expired idea that was exciting when it first came and totally needs to be revamped and reimagined in a socialistic framework. Any person who was born in America, specifically somebody whose family had to once upon a time cook for other families for free, should not have to worry day to day about how they're going to feed anybody. And it shouldn't be a question of if I'm having steak or shrimp or if I'm having what you think I should be having. It should be, this is how we eradicate certain types of crime, certain types of violences. And I think that's how come these things aren't going to stretch because, you know, no matter what, Biden or whatever the next Democrat is going to be, they can do all these kind of adjustments, but that's not really what people want, right? People want a revolution of that. People want something that sounds totally new, and food stamps is something that sounds totally old. And I think during my personal experiences with it, I felt how humiliating and out of step it was to be in the richest country, in the richest city in America, and me have to even ask or apply. This should be something that it just happens. Housing, food, shelter. These are things that should just be supplied to us and we shouldn't have to apply to them. And I think that is the tension because, you know, Democrats are corporately bought. So they're like, we ain't doing that.
When I was a kid, you know, I lived with my grandparents. My grandparents didn't receive public assistance, but they were not above buying food stamps when people were selling them. You know what I mean?
Oh,
I think a 2-for-1, you got 3 kids and all their cousins and
to
all their homies
day
in the house. Listen, you're going to buy them 2-for-1. Okay.
Pod say the people are, if you got some stamps and you trying to do 50, and you trying to do 50 on the dollar, come holler at your day then.
Oh my God.
But when I was in college, I went to college in a pretty wealthy county. And so the county offices actually were reaching out to those of us who were first gen college students and who were, you know, there on, you know, financial, if I were receiving pretty significant financial aid packages to tell us that we could qualify for food stamps. Right. So my first couple of years in college, baby, I was at Safeway whipping out that card. No problem. Right. Because I lived in an apartment on campus. I didn't have a meal plan. The dining hall was expensive and it wasn't enough salt in that food, you know, and it really did make it so that I could have a work study job, and that work study job prepared me for the career that I went on to have in education, right? And absent that safety net, absent being able to feed myself, you know, living for the first time on my own, I would have had to take on a full-time job. And who knows what that would have meant for my academic performance, the relationships I had, the ability to build on campus, and again, my ability to take a work-study job that helped better prepare me for my post-college career. So shout out to Santa Cruz County for that.
It's interesting the way that some states have dealt with the stigma of food stamps. I feel like I might have said this before, but Teray, my sister's a principal in Delaware, and during COVID, the state was trying to figure out how to give money to families and to people. So everybody got food stamps, everybody, regardless of income. If your kids and stuff, like, everybody got food stamps. So Teray also had a food stamp card, and she was like, it was so interesting because she had never been on public assistance, but all of a sudden every parent, she's like, everybody at the grocery store got food stamps. So the stigma was all of a sudden gone because literally it was the only way to do it. And I was like, this is actually really interesting.
I wanted to say something because I was wondering about COVID, and I was wondering about food stamps, these social programs, and also, I guess when you ask the average American how they feel about socialism, you'll get a array of different answers. But during COVID, everybody loves socialism.
Literally.
Yes.
So like,
yes.
What I've kind of noticed is that COVID rang a bell because people were getting this certified income, this certified, this is what you can get for food stamps, like, et cetera, when you were in COVID. And I feel like that has rang a bell both in the left and the right. I think the right are like always going to be screaming welfare queen. They've been doing that for decades now, and that's just going to mutate. But I also think on the left, it has created people who have seen how good it could be, as much death and as much, just heinous things happened during COVID. I think that is one thing that this produced, is people who are kind of maybe even stubbornly hooked there of being like, no, you actually can afford to give me $150 a month and $600, $150 in food and $600 to help pay my rent. And I feel like we're living in the aftermath of people trying to wrap their heads around, oh, we're not going to do that. We can, but we're not.
Don't go anywhere. More Pod Save the People's coming.
In further dystopian news, I am here to talk about a group of tech bros who have decided to join the Army Reserve. So we'll link to this piece, but it's a piece that was published in the Free Press, which is Barry Weiss's new media company. And if you know Barry Weiss, you can probably already imagine what's happening over there. By the way, I just recently learned that Barry Weiss is queer. So happy Pride Month, Barry. Anyway, Shyam Sankar, who is the CTO of Palantir, wrote an op-ed in the Free Press announcing that he had joined the Army Reserve's newly formed Detachment 201, which they are calling the Executive Innovation Corps. They are talking about it as bringing the best thinking, you guys can't see my air quotes, from the tech world into the military. And part of the reason that I wanted to bring this to the pod is I think over the past two generations, at least, people who have had class privilege in the United States have, for the most part, dissuaded their children from thinking about careers in the military, right? And what we are seeing, at least in this piece and in this announcement, is a shift. And I want to talk about why, because I think there are some dots for us to connect. So go ahead and pull out your tinfoil hats, good people. But I want to talk about the other folks who have joined him in this. So he says, receiving their commissions at my side will be some of the most impressive minds from the world of technology. Kevin Weil, the chief product officer of OpenAI, Andrew Bosworth, the chief technology officer of Meta, and Bob McGrew, formerly the chief research officer of OpenAI and engineering director of Palantir Technologies, where I work as chief technology officer. So these are like big wigs with deep pockets, with tons of influence, taking these commissions. And I just want to talk about, one, that's happening. I think it's really important that it be on people's radar. But two, want to talk about why we think that's happening and what else we should be on the lookout for.
I just want to say, it goes without saying that this idea that civilians in tech suddenly become lieutenants in the Army Reserves, like, just randomly would be, I mean, if Obama, Biden, anybody had tried to do this, every retired general in the history of generals would be on TV, like, what a disgrace to the uniform. And they don't have to do basic training. They don't have to do it. They will just come in as lieutenants. That's how I feel about the parade that Trump put on. I don't know if you saw, but it was like nobody was there. And but the tanks in the street, for instance, did you see this? The tanks are projected to have made $14 million worth of damages on the streets.
Yes.
That they will have to clean up. Just a mess. So the only thing I have to say about this is that it's been interesting to watch the army, who, regardless of party, has traditionally been just like a group of, obviously more conservative, but certainly about tradition and all those things. And then you see that the tradition is whiteness and you're like, oh, okay, well that is, because the stuff he's doing, like the speeches at the graduations, making people lieutenants in the Army Reserve from the tech community on a whim, like all these things would just have been politically impossible just a few years ago. And if not for us talking about this, I don't think I even saw this anywhere. I didn't see it on Twitter. I didn't see it on Instagram. And the ecosystem of information is so screwed that they are really controlling more of what we see in a way that is, well, I don't have anything deep to say besides this is just shocking. And I'm shocked that all the generals are just like, la-di-da.
Yeah, I think it was probably the best week to do it because everybody was talking about the parade, right? And everything. So it was really good to talk about it. I think because our stereotypes around Nazi Germany was also like the sycophant part and like the having a big fan base, we can kind of get lost in that. But like right wingers have traditionally not participated in civic engagement, even for themselves. Like even like we can think of those times that it happens, and they kind of they're emboldened in our heads because we think about some cult, KKK, etc. And I think the weird moment around this is that now they got their way and the government is being unraveled. And I don't know if those people necessarily show up and support Trump all the time. But what I do know is that this story showed a very clear dot between technological power and militaristic power. What I do know is that they're deploying National Guard, Marines, civilians. I do know that, to me, it seems like they're creating like a network of people who can comply with one another. And when things, I don't know, like when the volume to the fashion goes up a notch, you have people who are able to comply with that. And to me, that's what's the scariest part about it, is because it's happening right in front of our faces, but we seem more distracted by the things that maybe once upon a time could have been a signal of where things are going to go. But now it's kind of beyond that because everything's digital. Everybody's isolated. So I don't know if parades are a good measure of us being in a fascist nation in 10 years. Like, you know.
But you feel specifically, like this is...
Specifically post-Elon. You know what I mean? I'm just thinking about all the things they're willing to do. So no matter what anybody wants to say, if the election was free and fair, I think they should still investigate it. But I still think that something happened with the election. I still think that Republicans will do voter suppression. I still think that there is an ultimate plan that outlives Donald Trump in order to employ certain types of white supremacist fascist regimes. And this is just happening in layers. So like, I think that this kind of appointing and this kind of normalization is a gateway to that kind of nation in that kind of world. So I am coming to you from planet Black Heaven. And here on planet Black Heaven, we watch things that feed our spirit and feed our senses of humor. So today's news, partly in celebration of Juneteenth, because I think when I think about Black people finding out that they're free, I automatically think about Maya Angelou and Nikki Giovanni. And then both of them have done like really great public meditations on laughter and Black laughter and how Black laughter almost can't be trusted. And only Black people can hear real Black laughter versus the Black laughter that we do in order to stay safe inside of assimilation. And that makes me think about, oh, what are some things that I've enjoyed in my life that brought a type of laughter that gets you kicked out of church, that gets you kicked, punched in your kneecaps during the funeral? What are those things that just kind of just rile me up? And one of those things is living single. I believe that Black folks in sitcoms in the 90s, I want them to start doing comparisons between those comedies and Shakespearean comedies. I think that when you think about a post vaudeville, post that kind of 1970s variety show, and then also that kind of post Norman Lear era of television, I think that in the 90s, there was such an interesting amalgamation of so much good writing, so much good performance. And I think Living Single sits as the site of all that excellence and also all that kind of, albeit neoliberal, pop-like possibility making. I don't think that you have as many people interested in media without Khadijah, or so as many Black women interested in law without Maxine Shaw. I also don't think that you have as big of a breadth of Black femme possibility or Black bohemian possibility without Kim Cole's character as Sinclair or Kyle as Max and stuff. And then also, last thing I'll say around the actual show is that you have a lawyer, you have a stock, a magazine owner, somebody who does stocks, you have all these people, and then you have a plumber. So you have all these different people of different class backgrounds loving each other on something based differently than their careers and their class positions, which is something that just does not happen today in any community, especially the Black community that feels important. So anywho, Erica Alexander and Ken Coles created a re-listening, reliving, living single podcast. And when I tell you, it has brought me joy, not just in nostalgic way of looking back at these episodes, but also hearing Erica Alexander, Kim Coles talk about their craft, talk about their acting, talk about the science behind comedy. I think sometimes because of minstrelsy and stereotypes around Black people, we think that Black people making you laugh doesn't need craft and intelligence, and they show you right there that it does. They also talk to the wardrobe stylists, the writers on the show, and it just shows you how many things must work harmoniously together in order to produce excellence. And that has just been such a beautiful reminder for me to sit inside of every week, and I wanted just to share that with you. If it wasn't on your radar, if you never heard of Living Single or never watched it, I think this would be a great time to watch it, and this would be a great companion piece for it. And it's just been really cathartic and beautiful to see, and it has recalibrated me to be able to go into darker places by being kind of washed over by so much Black joyous light. And I wanted to offer that to you all as recommendation this week.
This has nothing to do with Living Single, but I did the keynote at a library media specialist thing the other day, and as people were coming in, I was introducing myself, and this woman said she was like, you signed the book. And I was like, what's your name? She said her name was Sandra. And I was like, Sandra Clark from 227. If you remember the wonderful 227, and I love 227. It was such a beautiful show. And I think about Living Single, I think about 227. I think about these shows that were out when before streaming and everything. So like, we all watched it, whether you liked it or not, actually didn't matter. You watched it. So Maxine was my first lawyer. Like they could, like all of the, like they all mattered, and they were sort of part of your life because it was a shared experience that so many generations of Black people had. And when I think about my niece and nephew, and I think about even a generation younger than me, they sort of don't have those same shared experiences. Like a lot of them watch sort of the thing on Netflix this week, but once the week passes, they're sort of, or the idea that you had to watch it because you that was the only way to watch the episode is like a foreign concept to get today. But it was, yeah, you had to like get to the TV. And if you did not get to the TV, you would not see it. You don't know. They might play it next week. This is how I felt about X-Men. There would be a new show, but you don't know if it's the right episode. Like they might do a rerun. You're like, get me out of here.
Yeah.
But we all watched Living Single. So I think your read on the political significance is right. It's so great to see Erica's career sort of come back after a period where like it was Living Single, and then it was like we didn't see her anymore. And then now we see her in a lot of things, including the podcast. And I do miss those shared experiences, especially in Black. I think about that with gospel music too. I'm like, I don't even know what funerals or whatever will look like in 20 years when don't nobody know the songs. I'm like, what a weird thing.
Yeah. I treat living single whenever I have people over to my house and I'm hosting, living single is always on because it's on Hulu and the TV is muted, but there's music playing and people are milling about and all of that other stuff. But people are always like, oh, is this the episode where, right? And like, that is always like an opportunity for people to just kind of engage. I also just love like the visuals and the aesthetic of the show, right? Cause I think to Miles's point, there are just like so many different kinds of Black people. And usually like the episodes are kind of fun or funny. Speaking of like nieces and nephews, right? Like, and to your point about them not having something similar, I feel like Living Single was on TV at a time when like Black TV, you had options, you know what I mean? And like I have a group of friends who had kids early, like, you know, they were the friends who had kids as teens and early 20s. And then a bunch of us like waited until our late 30s, early 40s. But the kids who are my friends' kids, right, who are now in their 20s, like they talk about Living Single as if it was a show they watched in real time. You know, you're like, baby, you were watching that in syndication. That was like not, you were not watching. I shouldn't have been watching it in real time. You definitely were not watching it in real time. But I think the images and the characters and the storylines are enduring. And I think they are enduring both because there is an absence of something similar now and some of that shared experience like you're talking about, DeRay. But I also think they are enduring because, this is to Miles's point, just the roundness of the characters, like the full development of who they were as people, the thoughtfulness of the writers, the fact that like the actors like poured their hearts into those characters, I think just comes through episode after episode, series after series. And like the rewatch, when you have a different lens and you've lived a little bit, you're like, I did not catch that joke the first time around, right? is also really fun. And I have a niece who's 14. And if you ask her, she met the version of me that is Regine, right? But when I was watching because I'm her rich auntie, that's what she thinks anyway. But, you know, when I was watching the show, I very much thought I was Maxine. You know what I mean? And I just think even having those archetypes to talk about the different ways, especially as my niece is, you know, entering her teens, like for real, and thinking about the kind of woman she wants to be. Also just saying like, you can have a good time, you can be serious about your career, and those things don't have to be mutually exclusive. And so they provide an entry point to conversation between the two of us. And I'm immensely grateful to Yvette Lee Bowser and the other folks behind the show for that.
I just want to shout out, because I didn't say it in my news, but I want to shout out Yvette Lee Bowser because she is the creator, she is the writer, and it's brilliant. And to your point, Sharonda, what you made me think of just really quickly is I think one of the reasons why culturally and when it comes to entertainment, we just don't see that type of power or interest is because Living Single did operate in this alternative Black reality. It looked really similar to our reality, but it was this optimal Black reality that all these characters lived in, and it was Afrocentric, and it was centered around them, and it was positive, and if something bad happened, it got, like, you know, like it just was kind of this kind of self-corrective mechanism to maybe what was really happening in the 90s and post-80s to Black people. And now we don't really have that. We have a whole bunch of mirrors who are willing to show you this is what's really going on and this is what's really happening, but you don't really have people like the creator of Girlfriends, the creator of Living Single, who were really instrumental in creating an alternative Afrocentric reality that looked like your reality but was optimal in other ways that I think really helps our imaginations.
Hey, you're listening to Pod Save the People. Stay tuned, there's more to come. And now my conversation with Brad Lander, who's running to be the next mayor of New York City. He started his career in politics as a New York City council person from 2010 to 2021, and is currently the 45th comptroller of the city of New York. I'm excited for you to hear Brad talk about what it's like to run for mayor, why he's running for mayor, the election's coming up, and here we go. Brad, it is an honor to have you on Pod Save the People.
DeRay, great to be with you. Thanks for the invitation.
Now let's talk about you running for mayor. When did you decide that you were going to do this? You already hold a big office. You've been in politics for a long time. What was the decision to run for mayor?
You know, I love the city. I've really enjoyed the job as controller. I'm making city government run better. But when Eric Adams sold us out, this was before he sold us out to Donald Trump, just when it was clear he sold us out to the Turkish government for illegal campaign contributions, I thought, this is a guy who's scapegoating asylum seekers, who's not running the city well, and City Hall's just too corrupt. So it was really after that that I thought, we need a new mayor.
Now, let's zoom out. Is you currently hold one of the three elected citywide elected offices in the city. Can you tell people, like, what does the comptroller do? And then how do you think that, like, sets you up to be an effective mayor?
Yeah. So I like to tell people the comptroller is the chief financial officer and the chief accountability officer. So as chief financial officer, manage the pension funds, finance the infrastructure, oversee the budget. So I have saved taxpayers over $2.5 billion. I know how to get every penny of taxpayer money to the services people need. And then as chief accountability officer, you audit every city agency. So I know how they work and how they don't work. But when the housing department makes it take 8 months for a low-income family to get into a home that's ready right now, makes me mad. So I know how to run the city better. I know how to use the funds we have to make the city more affordable and safer and more livable and better run for all our families. So yes, controller is good training to do the job as mayor.
And let's zoom out even more than that. And can we just start with, like, what made you get into politics? Like, why was this a thing? You could have done a million things. Why politics?
Yeah. And, you know, I had a 15-year career before I was in politics. I ran two nonprofit, affordable housing and community development groups. And I started working with my neighbors to fix up abandoned buildings and turn them into affordable homes. In a lot of cases, the people would own themselves as cooperatives, working together with their neighbors. And I was just a kid at the time. I was like 23 when they hired me to do this. And I loved it. Like, here's this chance to make the city work better for people. And, like, everybody's families have a home they could afford in a neighborhood they felt safe in with a good school by working together. And what I realized was I was good at working the levers of government in partnership with people, trying to make their neighborhoods better. And I just got addicted to it, really. And I love doing it as a nonprofit leader. And then when the council seat came open, I thought, huh, I could do that in the city council. And for 12 years, I helped invest in our schools and especially work on affordable housing. I got to work with unions to help a lot of workers have decent jobs, fast food workers and Uber drivers and deliveristas. And each time when you see people get together and say, hey, this city could work better for us, and that guy, he's our partner, he can help on the inside to make it happen, I love doing it. So I'm grateful for the, you know, the opportunities I've had and excited by the city I know we can have.
You know, it's interesting. I was talking to a group of activists, older activists in New York City who've been around for a long time. And I'm like, who are you supporting for mayor? And one of the things they said about you, they were like, say what you will about Brad, he's delivered for us. They were like, he has delivered. We know that he's delivered. That was sort of like all they said. And I was like, okay. So I'm interested in, and what do you think your, or what are the proudest accomplishments that you've had when you think about the things you have been able to get done?
Yeah, thank you. It's nice to hear they said that. So, I mean, so 15 years ago, I teamed up with Jumaane Williams when Bloomberg was doing stop and frisk all over the city. We passed the Community Safety Act and stop and frisk came down dramatically. The middle schools, the school district I used to represent had 11 middle schools. They were extremely segregated. And a few of us said, you know what, we could desegregate these middle schools. And a bunch of people said, that is crazy. That's a third rail issue. Why would you take it on? But we knew we could do it. And we have. Those schools are dramatically more integrated than they were. And they're doing really well. And parents feel good about them. Let's see. I mentioned a couple of the bills to make this a better city for workers. We became the first city in the country where Uber and Lyft drivers and deliveristas are guaranteed a living wage, where fast food workers have stable schedules and can't be fired on the whim of their bosses, where freelancers and gig workers are protected against getting stiffed out of money they've earned. Those are all my laws. Today, somebody said how great it was that Andrew Cuomo's super PAC has to say DoorDash is the biggest donor. That's my law. and then as controller, we invest this $275 billion pension fund. We've divested it from fossil fuels. We've invested in more affordable housing. We've had the backs of workers. We've increased the amount of it that's managed by Black and Latino and MWBE investment managers by 40%, $6 billion. And maybe lastly, sorry, I'm going on, but you asked. I was the only council member who said, I want my neighborhood to have a lot more housing, including a lot more affordable housing. And so we redeveloped the area around this polluted industrial canal called the Gowanus Canal. And now 8,000 homes are rising, 3,000 of them genuinely affordable to low-income and working-class families. There's 1,500 public housing units nearby. We leverage that redevelopment to get every one of them is getting fixed up, but staying public housing. There's new open space, new infrastructure. There's even 130 affordable artist studios coming. And the first couple of them are going to be public housing residents getting a chance to be artists in this city where almost no one has affordable studio space. So that model for like growth that actually is affordable and inclusive around the Gowanus Canal, that's going to play out for years to come. And I feel really proud of it.
Boom. Let's talk about three issue areas. We'll start with housing because that is where you started in your career. Rent is crazy. It's too expensive in the city. It's so expensive, even for like one bedroom with studios. What can you do as mayor to make that not so expensive?
Crazy. And let me just tell my story here quickly. You know, in 1996, my wife and I were able to buy a two-bedroom co-op in Brooklyn for $125,000.
Shut up.
And like, that's why we were able to raise our family here. And like, all I want for any family is the opportunity that we got, you know, to feel like, okay, I'm not going to get pushed out of my home and my neighborhood. And yet so many people feel that way all the time. So first, we have to protect tenants and make sure they don't get pushed out. We're supposed to be giving everyone a lawyer if they face eviction in housing court. We were up to 2/3, but Eric Adams has let it fall below 40%. You're way more likely to get kicked out of your home if you don't have a lawyer when you're facing eviction. The landlords always have them. So there's much stronger tenant protections. We can keep rents down by having the Rent Guidelines Board keep the rent flat this year and always working to keep it as low as we can. But to give people that opportunity my wife and I had, we have to build a lot more housing targeted to be affordable to people. So my favorite part, you know, I've got a lot of plans. I want to build 500,000 homes over 10 years. But the most fun one is I asked people, what city-owned land could we actually look at? And they came back and said, Controller, do you know the city owns 12 golf courses.
Really?
And that's 2,500, New York City, not, you know, there's private courses, whatnot. The city of New York owns 12 golf courses. And I mean, I don't have any problem with golf, but I think 8 golf courses would be plenty. On 4 of those golf courses, we could build 50,000 affordable homes for New Yorkers, not just to rent, but to buy, like, you know, my wife and I had that opportunity to do. We have this old program called Mitchell Llama that's these co-ops that you could buy at a reasonable price. A working class family could. And we could build great new neighborhoods with courtyards and beautiful new parks and childcare and libraries, like a 21st century working class city. So that's going to be 50,000 new homes on 4 of the city's 12 golf courses as part of a bigger housing plan, but that piece will restore that pathway to affordable homeownership for families who deserve it, but just can't even imagine it right now.
Boom. Now, what about public safety? You know, in your role as comptroller, you obviously deal with the police and the settlements, which are so much money already. Yeah. And New York City is safer in terms of homicides, and it's been in a very long time, which is cool. But what would you do about the safety question? Because it is always top of mind for people.
Yeah. Well, the nice thing here is my number one public safety plan is that as mayor, I'm going to end street homelessness for people with serious mental illness. And when I talk to people about where they feel anxious, the subway is usually top of the list. And it's true, if you get on the subway and you see someone who's not well, maybe some days you think that person's, you know, probably not a threat to me, but then you go home and you hear from someone who got pushed, or you see a story on the news, and the next day the same person makes you feel anxious. And I have a friend whose 8-year-old got pushed on to the, he got pushed down by, you know, a mentally ill person who's homeless. But here's the thing, we don't have to be a city where a couple thousand of our mentally ill neighbors sleep on subway platforms and sidewalks and the stoops of our building. We have the resources to connect them to stable housing and services. And lo and behold, they're doing it in other cities like Houston and Denver and Salt Lake City. Here, what Eric Adams says is basically move along. We send cops, they displace you, and you move somewhere else for the night. But it never gets you connected to stable housing and services. This policy called Housing First, where you offer people, instead of a shelter bed, a unit of supportive housing or an SRO with services, it works to keep people stably housed 70 to 90% of the time. So when we implement that policy here, the city's going to feel a lot safer because you'll see many fewer homeless mentally ill folks on the subway. And at the same time, it'll be such a more humane city because those folks will be getting the care that they need. There's a lot else, you know, look, for gun violence, for violent crime, having an effective and fair police force is critical, but no amount of policing is going to connect a mentally ill homeless person to stable housing and services. So we've got to have a city that does both.
And let's talk about education. I started my career out as a sixth grade math teacher in East New York, Brooklyn, in Starrett City, which, you know, feels like so long ago at this point. But would love to know about, you know, 3K, full day pre-K. What do we do about the high schools? What is your plan for education?
Yeah. So, you know, my mom was a public elementary school guidance counselor her whole career. I went to public school all my years, and my kids both went pre-K to 12 in New York City's public schools. There's just no institution that is more important to the future of this city, but we're barely talking about it in this race. So I think I'm the only candidate in the race with a real comprehensive education plan. Here's how I'm going to measure what matters in our schools. Here's how we're going to deal with the fact that 1 in 8 kids was homeless, and we got a growing mental health crisis and increasing chronic absenteeism. So two big ideas for the school. Well, one is, yes, like a lot of the other candidates, I want to expand childcare, get not just all 3-year-olds, but all 2-year-olds access to free universal childcare. We don't ask how much like third grade will cost. Should that be free? You know, and honestly, the same thing is true for 2- and 3-year-olds as well. It ought to be free and universal and high quality with decently paid teachers. Absolutely. I've seen this model in schools called a teacher center, which sounds so obvious when you say it, but it's just like a room in the school with a professional developer or instructional coach who brings the teachers in to work together with each other, talk about what's working, what's not working, learn the new curriculum, use the data they have on their kids, and focus on their own professional development. And it works so well. So I want a teacher center in every school. And I want every school to have the features of a community school. After school is a part of that. And so is working with the organizations in the community to help parents find the resources they need. If you're in an immigrant neighborhood right now, somebody's got to tell you, hey, go talk to that lawyer before you head down there. If you need, you know, is your kid getting the dental services? Like when you make schools community schools, really magical things happen. And then let me tell you just one last public school thing, although it goes to higher ed. Last week, I got to be the commencement speaker at City College, which is the flagship for CUNY, and 1,000 kids graduating. You know, I asked, if you're a first-generation college student, please stand. Almost everyone stands. If you had to work during school, almost everyone stands. If you're a parent, a lot of them stood. If you're the immigrant or the kid of immigrants, and basically everyone is standing. The valedictorian is a young woman named Aylin, who got here 6 years ago from El Salvador not speaking English. Now she is the valedictorian of one of the best public colleges in America, and she's coming to work for the New York City Department of Homeless Services to bring her psychology degree into the shelter system of New York City. And like, that's what happens when you get government right, is not only can you help her elevate, you can inspire her to be part of serving New Yorker, the rest of New Yorkers. And that's the magic our public schools make happen.
I love it. As we close, what else do you want people to know about the campaign as they Google you or go to volunteer or...
Yeah. I mean, look, what I'm offering is a big progressive vision, like the progressive values that New York depends on, that we need to stand up to Donald Trump to make the city more affordable, and the managerial chops and experience to deliver on my promises. I know how this government works and doesn't, and I can make it work better to give working families those affordable homes, those good schools for their kids, those great parks, those safe neighborhoods. So if you got progressive values and you value the managerial or the leadership experience to deliver on them, that's the candidacy I'm running. I think your listeners probably are not ranking Andrew Cuomo anywhere on their ballots, but I do want to like underline that, like not at number five, nowhere on your ballot. He was a corrupt and abusive governor. He's running a corrupt and abusive campaign. Everyone knows he sexually harassed those women. The idea that we don't talk about it is kind of appalling. He would be a corrupt and abusive mayor. He does not deserve your trust. So I hope you'll rank me first. You can find out more about me at landerfornyc.com. And then rank the other working families candidates. And let's build a city worthy of Aylin and all those families.
Boom. Well, we consider you a friend of the pod and can't wait to have you back.
It was great to talk to you. Thanks.
Well, that's it. Thanks so much for tuning in to Pod Save the People this week. And don't forget to follow us at Pod Save the People and Crooked Media on Instagram, Twitter, and TikTok. And if you enjoyed this episode of Pod Save the People, consider dropping us a review on your favorite podcast app. And we will see you next week. Pod Save the People is a production of Crooked Media. It's produced by Adre Moultrie and mixed by Charlotte Landis. Executive produced by me, and special thanks to our weekly contributors, Miles E. Johnson and Sharon DeBossier. Our production staff is proudly unionized with the Writers Guild of America East.